Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. There is some mystery to the healing process, but what we do seem to know intuitively is that unless we believe in what we're doing to heal, it's less effective. I wonder then why it is that some people see physicians that they don't like. To carry it further, if it's important how and what we believe, might it also be possible for belief itself to be important in order to heal? Although the idea of being healed by the intervention of another through their compassionate gifts sounds appealing, how many have the courage to join with the healer and surrender to something beyond but not separate from ourselves? I'm joined today by energy healer Greg Shelkin, and we'll be discussing the art of spiritual healing. Greg Shelkin was introduced to psychic healing when he accompanied his mother and aunt to the Philippines for treatment, for them being treated in 1972, and he was encouraged to return 2 years later to do a documentary film on Native healers when his own 17-year migraine condition was cured by their treatments. As he interviewed the man who was to become his teacher, he was told that he had a rare latent healing ability which could be cultivated and developed. Shelkin began an intensive training program lasting 2 years, and in 1986 he participated in a research project which concluded that hands-on healing is most effective when the client and the practitioner have a high degree of confidence in the outcome. So I'm very pleased to welcome Greg Shelkin. He is here with me in studio. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I know that you have a degree from an Ivy League college, and that your personal style doesn't sort of drip New Age, but you do believe that your gift comes from a higher power. Were you religious before you started your training?
Not religious as such. More my bent was a spiritual path, looking for meaning, a universal meaning. I mean, I went to college to study math and physics to find an order to the universe. Got a degree in art history where I found more meaning in the art of mankind.
So you wouldn't describe yourself as religious. You describe yourself as someone who has a faith in something larger. Is that you can describe
well,
it. I shouldn't describe it for you.
I've come back to my religion. In my work, I don't profess, I don't use my religion and hammer my religion into a person. I have my personal beliefs. I believe that everyone has their own personal beliefs. I have a sort of impromptu altar set up in my workspace that has a number of figures from different religions, including a can of organic tomatoes for devout vegetarians.
Aw. But they're in cans.
Oh, I know.
You should get one ripe organic tomato.
And tough put it to on keep the on the shelf.
Okay. Well, you have to keep changing them. I would think that would be the first hurdle, because some of us, I almost call myself an atheist, except that I studied Zen Buddhism very seriously as a young person, and it's completely formative in what I believe. So I can't really. I would say for myself that I'm an atheist in terms of believing in an entity, but that there is something that Buddhists believe in, which is this sense of a total potential, a space of total potential, which has a sort of...
Well, everyone has a belief.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And that's what moves our spirit.
Okay.
And that's what's important.
That's what's important. So it doesn't. You don't run into a logjam when you get someone who's an atheist?
No, I don't.
You just have to feel what it is that they're, where the opening is, huh?
In the Philippines, the people I studied with and learned with were called espiritista, or spiritualists, spiritual healers. Mm-hmm. I learned about my religion there, but I also saw when I came here to this country to call myself a spiritual healer would not work. Can't come back to the States. But I found I wanted to embrace more people and not put a... roadblock up for them by saying I was a spiritual healer or a Christian healer, but just to allow people, by calling myself a psychic healer, to become more generic, to allow people to have whatever belief and
yes.
faith they have.
Yes. I'm wondering what you had to let go of or give up in order to do this work. Do you understand what I'm asking? You must have had to take some kind of abrupt right turn, because this wasn't something that you automatically... You were skeptical when you went with your family to the healer, and then suddenly you had this experience. You know?
Well, when you have the experience of my 17 years of migraine headaches, of weekly headaches, and having those disappear, and having a clarity of vision for the first time since I was a child, changed my whole life. Opened me up and allowed me to... What I had to give up was, in some ways, my skepticism mm-hmm. and my unwillingness to allow what I really believed and felt.
So it made it easier for you to trust your intuition?
Exactly.
And so what you let go of was maybe something slightly self-defensive?
And comes back in waves to be dealt with. Again and again.
I have to think that's so, because it's so embedded in our cellular structure by the time
true.
We get
lifetimes
to... Lifetimes. Yes. You practiced, or you studied intensively for 2 years, but you've been practicing this work for a long time. Do you have a sense of how much training is necessary for someone to really begin to put their hands on someone?
Well, my teachers... And my teaching came as an apprenticeship, which I believe is one of the best ways to work. It's you get your hands on people immediately under the supervision of your teacher. So you're always learning. My teacher's favorite teaching tool was an expression, "Oh, you'll know."
Yes.
So he gave me the opportunity to find those answers within myself through working on with patients.
One of the things I've observed as I've... we just discovered we're the same age. And one of the things I've discovered through my life is that anything that you set out to learn intensively and study intensively, even whether it has a spiritual cast or whether it's something just practical, like, you know, I worked as a designer in my youth, or, you mm-hmm. know, when I was young, affords you an opportunity to sort of, in a negative way to say this, but to be offended by so many things. Once you become sort of good at something, there's a whole world of things that you see out there that are sort of need to be fixed. And I'm... Maybe you don't go there. Maybe this
point,
is characteristic to me.
Yeah, sure. In the beginning, I wanted to heal the world.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
You go at and say, how many people can I bring together to have this experience?
Yes.
And how big an experience can this be?
So it becomes almost megalomaniacal.
Well, you do.
So, do you also find that you can turn this off and on? I mean, do you find yourself at a social gathering sensing what's going on with people? Do you feel... what's going on with people if you don't focus on it? Are you able to let this go when you're not working?
Well, it's always there, but one of the things, a big part of the training was to be able to call on it. A lot of people have had experiences where they've sat with someone who has then gotten well and call that a healing experience. It is a healing experience, and it's a wonderful experience of their praying or just being with that person, their intention, mm-hmm. intentionality, being mm-hmm. able to help and make a difference in that person's health. But then when you, to be able to do this day in and day out, to be able to have that same kind of focus, you have to know how to turn it on and
you have to be able
turn
to,
it off.
You have to be able to rest, I
yes.
think, and recover. So and you, yeah, go ahead, I'm
and
sorry.
And recharge.
So what are the things, I mean, I also have to think that there are certain practices that would increase your sensitivity, along with recharging you, that you might also have practices that you've developed over the years to literally hone and protect your skills, just like someone with an amazing voice. Anybody with a gift, there's almost...
Yeah, the old expression, practice, practice, practice.
No, but I mean in the sense of when you're on your own and you're not engaged with another person, are there things that you do, whether it's meditation or prayer, that help you to maintain your sensitivity?
Well, the most important aspect of healing is intentionality. And the most important thing I can do is to work on that clear vision of seeing my intention, which is the good in all people. So my practice is to go out and try to see that, experience that. Now it's with my granddaughter and my little puppy and my wife and family, you know, and my friends and the world as such.
So what we're talking about here reminds me of, you know, I asked you about this when we talked on the phone before we decided to do the show, of, you know, we've had opportunities in some, albeit Hollywood films, to get a glimpse of what this might mean. And one film that's actually one of my favorite films is Resurrection. And one comment you had about Resurrection is that her open-heartedness and her compassion and her love was right, but her taking on of the illness was not accurate to your experience. And I just, before we talk about that, I want to move on to the other one that comes to mind, because I just resaw it recently, which is the film Phenomena with Travolta, where he has this odd tumor that it lights up his brain so that he has increased capacity, and it brings up this issue of, oh, if we were just using more of our brain. But what really makes him able to be like he is, to have these special, is that his heart is so open, and what he learns through the experience is that everything is connected. So it has more to do with who he was and his soul than it had to do with his brain being stimulated.
Exactly. Again, that intentionality, that compassion toward, between patient and healer, is, or doctor, or whomever, is what will make the difference. Mental work, meditations, all the rest come. They will be exercises, but the real work is, there was a great exercise that was, I think it was Larry Lachon, another healer, used to use to teach his students, and that was to take two tomato plants, feed them, water them the same, except one you love and one you hate. And then, as the one you hated started to wither, be able to turn that around and take the one you hate and turn that into love, so that you could bring that one back. Because they would die with hate.
Yeah, I can see that that would work. I mean, I think that the tricky part, this is something that a Buddhist teacher that I like a lot, I haven't studied with her, but I like her very much, is Pema Chodron. Mm-hmm. And one of her major messages is to maintain open-heartedness. And, of course, what she says is what you'll discover when you try to do that is how little you can do it, how hard it is to do, and how many things cause you to contract away from it.
Well, the nature of open-heartedness, the nature of all life for me is not, and I think it's one of the pitfalls of the New Age, was that coming through the 70s, coming from the 50s and 60s and the 40s and our parents' generation, we saw them close down because of depressions and two world wars and Holocaust and whatever. We wanted to be open. We used drugs, we used whatever we could to get there. And then we put rubber stoppers in the doors to keep us open. The door in all of life is pulse. And so it works so that it's meant to open and close, and then open again and close again. And if we can get into the pulse and rhythm of that, that's when we experience a full life. So there is no darkness, there is no light.
Yes.
It's one into the other.
Yeah, the way they say it in Buddhism is moon-faced Buddha, sun-faced Buddha, doesn't matter, same thing.
Right.
So you get to a point where you forgive and accept whatever state is there, whatever is there. You start, I think, by doing that. I mean, if you feel contracted, you start by loving the contraction.
Right.
Yeah. That was wonderful. Thank you. let me just remind people that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm live in the studio with Greg Shelton, who is a energy healer. Incidentally, I think that people are going to want to contact you for appointments, and my understanding is that your practice is closed. Am I correct?
My practice is closed. I take a few referrals, specific referrals, but no,
You're very full.
Yes, I have my village.
Yeah, okay. So maybe as we get to the end of the show, we'll talk about what sorts of resources people can use to find someone like you to work with and what they might do.
That.
Yeah, let's do a little more of this, if we may. When I really thought about this, it occurred to me, because I have clients. I see people as a health educator. So I'm dealing with their energy in the room.
Right.
And it's a challenge. I think what I've observed is that learning and transformation happens when people are able to sort of join into, they both come to a kind of a different space, a mutual space, which is open. And some people can come there and some people can't. In other words, it's almost as if there's a room and you have to get the other person into the room with you. And some people can get to the room and they leave immediately, or they can stay there in the room with you. Do you understand what I mean? There's an almost kind of a sense of people have to offer themselves on some level in order to do some of this. Am I getting it wrong here?
Well, right. One, by their making the appointment and walking in the door, part of them wants to be in that room. They may not know how to get there. And as a practitioner, our job is to make them comfortable with just being there so that they can then participate.
So that might be the first step before anything else happens.
Yeah. We did an experiment back in the early 80s of brainwave synchronization and healing. It was because we talked about one of the first and most important things was to become one with the patient. And that means wherever they are, not to bring them into your space. So as the healer, what they looked for was a synchronization of my brain waves to the patients, and we had great success in that.
So what you're doing is managing to join them without letting go or relinquishing parts of yourself.
As in resurrection, that was that union.
That's okay.
And that got exaggerated into then
she takes on
the illness and did whatever with it.
Yeah, and you're saying that doesn't happen in the healings that you do.
No, not nearly that dramatic.
But occasionally it does.
Well, you feel it.
You
feel
do.
What that
you
person.
You feel the pain.
You have they call it clairsentience, a clear feeling, a sensory awareness of what's going on in the person.
Oh my!
I also see what's going on energetically because I work with a body, and an energy healer works with the body in an energetic form.
So that has to be difficult. I mean, if you're dealing with someone who has a serious cancer or who's in a lot of pain,
yes,
well, that must be very difficult.
You feel that, but again, for that moment, and the pulse takes it away and release that back to what I say, release it to the earth and to God.
Do you, we've talked about the fact that you have a closed practice. Part of this is because you're good at what you do. I mean, the way I found out about you is that somebody I'm very close to had a very serious experience happen to her and was left with a damaged larynx and esophagus. And she was referred to you, and you fixed it.
Right.
And I just, you know, my mouth just dropped open. She's somebody I'm very close, I used to be very close to. She's a dream worker. And, I thought, okay, I'm there. I have to talk to this man. I have to think that earlier, when your practice wasn't so full, when you didn't have so many people coming to you, and you were open to taking new people, did you, in fact, turn some people away because you sensed that you couldn't help them, partly because they couldn't?
I didn't know why. I would try, especially in the early days, if my practice wasn't full, I would work and see people at least one time. Just to see if we could make a difference.
Uh-huh.
But then I discovered that sometimes it wasn't appropriate, including, you know, the parents who brought their young son to see me with a cancer.
Yes.
And when I worked with the boy, I saw what the boy needed was radiation.
Wow.
And the difficult part was talking the parents.
Wow.
Out of merely doing, I said, I would be glad to work with him through that. But he really needs the radiation.
Wow.
I mean, he's fine today. And that was 12 years ago. But that's what he needed.
That's very interesting. It would be nice if you could train individuals to develop this kind of innate sense. I mean, I think people do have voices inside them that say, ooh, I think I ought to do it. I don't think I ought to do it. I, you know.
Well, there's a great book. There's two psychologists, Mark Barish and a woman who wrote a book called, I think it's called Remarkable Recoveries.
Mm-hmm.
124 case studies of people with a fatal prognosis to their cancers or whatever disease process, all of whom are now, quote, cured or in remission for over 5 years. Of the 124 cases, there are no two cases the same. And the one thing they discovered from that was people learned how to listen to themselves and follow their own personal path.
You know, from my perspective, What I often find is lacking is that we live in a culture where information is filtered for us. And it's even though people think we're in the information age and tons of information is there, one of the missions of my show is to uncover stuff that's not being delivered to people, information that they're not privy to. Researchers who are doing research that's extremely credible, but it's not being recognized or listened to because it breaks some convention or it doesn't fit in with the sort of standard of care model. That's sort of the horse that's not even the horse, the engine that's right. driving things right now, and a lot of it's economic. So my interest was always to give people encouragement to use their intuition, but also give them as much information that as possible that they may not have available to them.
And this is the gentle way of giving them information, as opposed to the person who gets ill and, as friends and family members find out what they have, they then not only give them information, but push
pound on them
yeah. to say,
so do the
you
doctors.
Have to do the oh, and doctors, of course.
Yeah.
You have to do it this way.
So one of the most important things is to never make a decision based on fear, and that's very difficult to do because I've had clients who I was working with who were deciding about a cancer treatment and who were not disposed to want to use conventional stuff. And I gave them the information that I have mm-hmm. about the yes, no, what, you know, you might need to think about. And they decided not to, and then their doctors just scared them so much that they did it and felt bad while they were doing it. So that, to me, is a real travesty.
That's the travesty, but we all have these beliefs, and I sometimes jokingly call them the cult of the white coats. They were taught their way. They have limited vision, limited scope, but they believe, and it's their belief, that if we do this way, you will get well. That's their belief.
Well, they also have malpractice hanging over them, too.
Well, there's a lot of other.
Yeah, they're frightened, I think, too. But they all, I hear what you're saying. What you're saying is that their intention is often a good one.
Yes.
They mean for the person to get well.
And it's all that they know.
Yeah. Yeah. So moving on to something that I read in one of these articles. Let me just make sure we're okay on time. Yes. You described the work as altering the energy in a client's or a person's system. This, of course, sounds a little bit like acupuncture and other things that move energy around. Qigong.
Well, it's the basis of acupuncture,
mm-hmm.
and Qigong is very similar. Every culture in the world has a different form of energy healing,
mm-hmm.
and we called it magnetic healing or spiritual healing. Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, his first treatise, non-religious scientific treatise, was on the laying on of hands.
Really?
Yes.
I
and that's the father
that.
Of modern medicine.
I had no idea.
Because he understood the energy moving between people.
Well, we also know from research on infants, for instance, that a child, a baby, will die if it's not touched.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's obvious that touch is powerful. But I also have to think then that, again, going back to the relationship between the healer and the client or patient, that it does have to feel right, and that means that when somebody goes in search of someone to help them, whether it's an educator like me or a healer or an acupuncturist or even a doctor, that the first caveat would be, how do you feel when you're with this person? Does it feel comfortable? Or is it possible that sometimes feeling uncomfortable might be appropriate?
Exactly. Sometimes it might be uncomfortable. Does this feel healing? Does this feel helpful? Sometimes, you know, it's the critical eye that feels helpful. You know, I need someone to cut through this for me. Sometimes I get so much of that. I need, you know, the person's real need in healing is the support system and the comfort. And anywhere in between on that spectrum. So, and you may move as their practitioner from one extreme to the other during the process.
Yeah, it's that breathing in and out thing you were talking about.
Again, yeah, being present with the patient.
There's another issue here that comes up in my work, and I think it might come up in your work, which is that there's that sort of line between supporting someone and giving them the capacity, increasing their capacity, or in my case their knowledge, in your case maybe capacity or energy. And then there's that line between doing that and also making them dependent or pacifying them.
You know, that someone described that to me as the difference between sympathy and empathy. And sympathizing was merely staying in that place with that person. Empathy was to feel with that person and keep, again, if you keep it moving, it moves.
Okay.
It's ever changing.
So does that mean that when you do an intervention and you give the person some energy to have something take place in their body that they couldn't move themselves,
mm-hmm.
is there a teaching on a cellular level that's going on so that the person can then maintain that?
Oh, definitely.
That's
what the energy...
That's what you hope for.
You hope for, and that's what you're working toward, is not what happens on my table, but more important to me, what happens when they leave my office, and what happens over that next week or 2 weeks or month or wherever.
Yeah, like if you cleared a roadblock and
right,
things
the
are circulating.
And it's seeded itself cellularly, then it's going to grow. And so what will be barely noticeable by other people in the moment grows and grows, so huge changes occur.
And the huge changes are actually occurring because of the sort of wholeness of who that person is, isn't it?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah,
you know.
I have to think that's so. Because I one of the things I've learned working the way I work and studying things that I study is that the body is like, it's almost like a child that really wants to do the right thing for you. It really wants to please you. Whatever, you can't really talk about there being an outside you, but I'm just saying that our whole body-mind has this quality of wanting to be cooperative. And very often, if we just get out of the way, the body will do its work. So I really believe in doing minimal interventions, if possible, initially, if it's possible to do that, because the body wants to do the right thing.
The body wants to be well. I mean,
yes.
I figure it's more limited than the rest of us. And how long it's here. So it really wants to be as well as it can. And if we can get out of its way or learn how to listen to it as well, listen to it instead of all too often we dictate to our bodies. And that comes from youth, where we usually push our bodies and tell it to do, oh, I want to go here, I want to go hit there, you know, another all-nighter, you know, we'll do this. And it just does it. And then we hit middle age and it's, now we've become partners instead of the dictator, the great dictator.
That's a good way of saying it.
And then in later years, our bodies really start running us.
Oh, God.
We've got that to look forward to.
Oh, goody. I can't wait. We need to just take a brief 30 to 35-second break, musical break. And when we come back, I'll continue my interview with Greg Shelkin, who is here in studio with me. Unfortunately, his practice is closed, so I'm not giving out contact information for him, but we will talk about how somebody might choose or find a healer to work with. I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm in the studio with Greg Shelkin, who is an energy healer, but you can't go see him because his practice is full. No, that's not true. He does work through referrals and stuff, but his practice is very full. He's been working for a long time. You can probably sense listening to this interview why his practice is full, but we will discuss in the second half hour how to find somebody to work with. I just want to remind you, if you missed parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-8255. 2772, or you can go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com. I have to ask you this question. We're talking about altering the energy in a client system. So can you alter the energy in your own system? I have to think you can.
Oh, you can.
Yeah, I have to think you can.
Much more difficult to do it on your own.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, my understanding is that's what Qigong basically is.
I mean, you could mobilize.
Yeah,
yeah.
To get you could go to a Qigong master and they can zap you. You know,
right,
although you kind of want to be careful who zaps you.
Always.
Always want to be careful who zaps you. Okay. Before we move, I do think that this is kind of part of the question of how to choose a healer. I noticed when I was reading the article where you were interviewed in 86, I guess it's the Yoga Journal or something, they brought up some issues that always make me angry, which is talking about the idea that some people want to be sick. You're rolling your eyes. I think this is a complete misunderstanding of basic human psychology. I think that people may have some very perverse ways of medicating and comforting themselves, but I don't think people want to suffer.
Not necessarily. I mean, in all my years, 30 years of practice, and beyond that to my family history, I have known fewer than a handful of people that I would even say came close to wanting to be ill.
Well, some people may not want to be alive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, their desire to be well. But that's part of another one of those trappings of the New Age became the blame game.
Yes. We went from thinking it was spirits that made us sick to thinking that it was all our fault.
Right. And to see that, here's some of my spirituality. It was taking it back to the book of Genesis and Adam and Eve. And it goes back to our Judeo-Christian tradition of original sin, that we're basically bad people.
Mm-hmm.
Except if you read the script, what it really says is that they had one God speaking to another, saying, they have become likened to us with knowledge of good and evil. Well, I don't know most people on any kind of spiritual path or in their lives really want to be better people. So, yes, we've become likened to gods. And yet, that's the original sin. And cast them out, lest they find their way to the fruit of the tree of life, which the Bible then becomes a journey to that end. It's about the fact that we're not bad people.
We just act that way.
Yeah, the powers that
be. I mean, it's hard for me. I mean, I
use fear.
Yeah, go ahead.
To keep us afraid and paralyzed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that they use, though, one of the fears that they use has been organized religion. So I'm one of those activists that can't, you know, I get...
Oh, I know.
I have a real problem because, I mean, I when I was very young, I lived in Mexico for a while, which is a very Catholic country, and I just saw, you know, how wounding it was in some ways. In other ways, you know, they had sort of converted it all to native religion.
Right, they used
and that
their
was pretty healthy.
Brought that
that
in.
Part was healthier.
Same in the Philippines.
Yeah, well, a very similar mestizo culture.
Right.
Well, okay. So you did this study in 86, and then and you were interviewed during that time, and now but there's been nothing else like that. It seems like what happened is that you were kind of out and about, and people were interviewing you, and you were being studied, and then you just got so busy that you just.
Well, no, it didn't. It wasn't that I got so busy. What happened was, when I came here from the Philippines, I knew two people. I was invited here by a patient I had treated for a terminal brain tumor. He invited me here to stay, to come and start my practice. In coming here, I met people who were doing research in parapsychology and the mystical arts, and I thought, oh, this is great. And my science background was taking me to maybe I can get them to tell the world that this is real. And I was looking for a validation. And I was guinea pigging more experiments than I wanted to measure. But then, at the same time, I met my wife, who was had a great influence on me and also reminded me of the fact that, you know, Greg, what do you do? What validation are you looking for? Where's your real validation here? Isn't it your patients who are getting well?
Hmm.
And I finally came to that as I worked on this last study. That was brought to me. I said, I'm doing this one, and this will complete it. And I didn't know. This was a graduate student's
work. For JFK.
For mm-hmm. JFK. It was a 2-year study. Mm-hmm. He turned into a 5-year study and then got published by Harvard School of Medicine.
Wow.
In their journal in 1994.
Wow.
And I was like, I came from the Ivy League. This went back to the Ivy League.
Oh, funny.
That completed it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the research is there. There's enough of it. There's enough being done today on other people. Dr. Larry Dossey has done incredible work documenting all the research.
Yeah, I've interviewed him a few times, and I actually once was lucky enough to be in studio with him, and he's very nice to be around.
Yes, he is.
He's really nice.
And so that's all there, and that just freed me up to do what I'm here to do, and that's
to help people get well. Yeah. Okay, so when someone has a critical diagnosis and they're looking for somebody, they want to try working with an energy healer, what's the first piece of advice? I mean, I'm assuming that you have several pieces of advice to give them, but what would be the first piece?
First piece is to talk to friends.
Who have had the experience? Or just see if anyone has.
you don't know. Okay. Most people don't think this think this world is so far from them.
Well, it's like my experience, you know, having somebody tell me the story about you. And I mean, I've had my own feelings about it. I actually have always been attracted to this idea a lot. But hearing her story, I thought, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And talking to people, you're going to hear someone, you know, that fifth degree of separation. Someone knows someone who knows someone.
Mm-hmm.
And you start tracking it down, start talking about it, and you find out that people you know, maybe in the office next to yours, in the cubicle there, has had an experience, a positive one. You find out, and it's a great way to go. Another way, if you've got no experience in these realms, is to walk into your health food store. It's sort of the platform 9.5 in Harry Potter. It's a gateway that gets you to...
It's the glass in Alice in Wonderland.
Exactly. You know, through the glass darkly, and you're there in Wonderland, you know, and they tend to know who's around.
Oh, how interesting.
So you want personal referrals.
Uh-huh.
It's very important. And then you want to communicate with the person.
Yeah, because, you know, their style might just be, you know, you show up at their house and they have a turban on. It's like, I'm sorry, look at the time. I have to go.
And I've had people walk into my office and not see the ropes
and be disappointed.
And go, oh, well, geez.
No, me too. Me too. Yeah. Yes, no, they kind of want me. Can't you just make me better? Yeah.
So you get out the terry cloth robe and, you know, my plastic beads.
Yeah, so I think that part of what we're saying is that it helps to know what your belief system is, what you're comfortable with, what resonates for you, and you find somebody who feels like finding a friend. You find somebody who's like that.
And I remember in freshman English, there was a phrase that they used that was called the willing suspension of disbelief, allowing yourself to try an experience.
Well, what that brings up for me then is how often does it go bad? Because I've had experiences with not hands-on stuff, but with body workers or acupuncturists who had very strong ideas about who I was and what I needed. Maybe that was my clue. Maybe I should have left as soon as I recognized that was happening, that they had an idea already. And those were pretty disastrous treatments, and I often felt very poorly afterwards.
Well, you usually don't want a person telling you who you are.
I'll say.
You want your practitioner. That's the same as... That's like going to a doctor. You can go to a doctor then. They'll tell you what you've got, who you are, you know, and what you have to do. A good practitioner is the one who's going to ask you who you are and try to find out from you what's going on and is listening to you. That's what you want. You know, are they present with you, or are they just quickly going into their whole thing?
Well, you know, it's very hard not to do that. I find that as an educator, I have a tendency to go, oh, I know what slot you're falling into. You're falling into this slot, and here, let me give you some. But I try to frame it as, here's what I know.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, you can either this will either resonate with you and you can try these things like changing your diet and taking these vitamins. You can see what happens.
Well, that's what I call the fine-tuning. You know, having seen as many people as we have and treated, it's like when you get that person with you, you say, oh, this is a lot. That's where I always have to catch myself. As soon as I say this is a lot like, or this is just like, or this is.
You know you're in trouble.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Because I have to ask them. Then I use that, like you said, from what I've seen, this happens. And look to how they respond.
Yeah.
So that you can, again, be more present with them.
So do you also give people, because, I tell people I do not treat them. I only educate them. I mean, I may make suggestions, but I don't treat. I don't consider myself treat. You do treat. But do you have follow-up? You do a hands-on. Do you then give people some instructions on you might experiment with this, you might experiment with that. I'm sensing that.
Yeah, when I at the end of the session, I will talk about what has gone I felt has gone on during the session and have some ideas or exercises. I like to give people homework so it empowers them because they begin to learn how they do make a difference in their own health. So instead of just going to everyone to make a difference, it's like Qigong.
Oh, they go to everyone. It's true.
You know?
People go to everyone.
And it's the way we're taught. I mean, here in this country, we can't even go into a pharmacia to buy our own antibiotics because we don't know enough. And we might get hooked.
Yeah, it's a culture of experts.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, empowering the person. And it's one of the best things you can do.
What about the yes butting? Do you get yes butting? I get yes butting. I say, you might experiment with it. Oh, I can't do that. Okay. Well, do you want me to just explain this to you and you can back burner it and see how you feel about it later?
And then you have to let go of it. Because you may find that even though they use the yes button in front of you, you've put it out there. You've sown the seeds.
Yes.
Let's see.
Yeah, sometimes leave time bombs in people, I think.
And there are times, I mean, one of the times things I love is when during the session, I've said a lot of things and we've talked a lot. And the person comes back and they're feeling great in a couple of weeks and things are changing in their life. And they say, Greg, what you said really made a difference. And you know exactly what you said. And they mentioned something totally different.
They heard something
and
else.
They heard something else completely, and it made the difference of their life.
Uh-huh.
And I go,
okay.
Terrific.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So would you say, I mean, I have to think that like anything else, there's going to be some really good energy healers out there, and there's going to be some people who are just not very good, not very effective.
Yeah, I compare it usually to musicians.
Oh, I would think, yeah.
You know, and when I sing in the shower, the neighbors call the police.
Right, right.
So, yeah, there are people who are really gifted and talented, and you'll find them.
And so part of what I hear you saying is that there are a lot of healers out there, that it's
there
not...
Really? There are a lot of healers.
Really? So a lot of people who are doing this must be very quiet. And in fact, you know, there's... I was once telling an acupuncturist who I really liked that I had gone to see another acupuncturist who spent the entire session that I had with him, the second one, telling me how eminent he was in China and how talented he is and how amazing he was. And the first acupuncturist, the one I had the relationship with, said, in China we have an expression, the empty pail makes much noise.
Very good.
So I have to think also that there's that aspect of all the people who are sort of... That isn't to say that everybody who writes a book and gets on radio shows... Automatically, they're no good because they're an empty pail making noise. I'm not saying that. Yeah, I'm not saying that. But I am saying that sometimes the people, because, I mean, I've interviewed some people who are considered to be sort of heavyweights. I don't mean to be bragging. I'm just saying somebody, wow, this person, whenever I get it. And I interviewed, early on in my show, I interviewed some people who were like, and in some cases, like, I'd even hear them before we got on air. You know, they'd say, what are we doing? I don't know. And they're all uptight. And they're supposed to be, this is this person who has this, like, public image who's supposed to be so, and they're completely the opposite of the way. So I have to think that part of the deal here might be that the more quiet, more hard to find, or more underground people, not that they're automatically going to be better, but that actually that might be an advantage if they're a little harder to find. I mean, that's an oversimplification.
Well, that could be. Mostly it's a culture that we don't have a great belief of this in our culture, so it's not sought after. So people with the gift or people who are practicing obscure it with their massage therapist or their acupuncturist or they're doing something else. But you start talking healing with people, and next thing you know, well, you know, I see this massage person who does. Or I do see this healer, but, you know, you got to keep it quiet.
Because it is, in a way, you do have to keep it quiet because there are, no?
That...
No,
that's
licensing.
That's from the 70s.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay. There's licensing. There's church.
No,
and state,
you can do things.
There are things you can do today that you couldn't. And now, I mean, even the hospitals have institutes
of
alternative therapies. Mm-hmm. California Pacific is doing studies with healers on brain tumors.
Wow.
And they just did, they completed it. It was based on a study they did with healers and AIDS 5 years ago.
That's fabulous.
So
they're around.
It's around. It's They're there. So if you ask, I mean, when I went to the Orient the first time and met my first healers, and I came back and I was in outside Boston seeing some friends and they knew where I had gone, I come back and I tell them, they want to know about my experience. I'm telling them all about these healers, and they said, oh, yeah, you know, because of you and healers, I've heard, you know, there's one up on the North Shore and one down the South Shore.
Yes.
And I said, oh, yeah, even here it's starting to happen. And they said, well, not quite. The one up on the North Shore is in her 60s, and she's been doing it for 45 years.
How interesting.
And the fellow down on the South Shore has been doing it for 20 years. Mm. And it wasn't that it just started happening, but because I became open to it, and the people around me who started talking, all of a sudden...
You found out.
You start becoming aware of this whole sector of our culture that is really there.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm in studio with Greg Shelkin, who is an energy healer. Unfortunately, his practice is full, but we're talking about the fact that people can find this kind of work by asking friends and people at health food stores and just really paying attention. You'll find these people who are good healers. You apparently have taken on apprentices at times.
Over the last 30 years, I've had 11 apprentices.
Very, very few. Is part of the deal that you can feel whether or not they have, quote, the gift or not?
Well, that's part of it, and also if I'm the fit to teach them.
Okay.
Some of them have the gift, and I am not the person to teach them.
But can you feel that about someone regardless?
Usually.
Okay, so there are some people... I mean, it isn't the case that although... you're plugging into something that's there for everyone, that everyone can't plug in quite as well, that some people are going to have more of a capacity for this than others.
We use the term gift.
Okay.
And some people are gifted in this realm.
Okay. I have to also think that if someone trains as an energy healer, that what they're learning is going to be a basic shift. I think we've already established this in the beginning of this, but to say it again, a basic shift in the way that they, your shift, for instance, becoming an energy healer, in the way, the whole way that you relate to the world, doesn't it change and shift your whole relationship to the phenomenal world or the spiritual world?
Yeah, well, my world was very limited and defined, and through my studies and my experience, I had wanted a world in black and white, hard-edged, and my world has grown incredibly and is, again, it's that pulse. It's a living organism instead of black ink on white paper any longer.
Do you think that being, forgive me for this, I'm sorry, but do you think being a male in our culture interfered for you with being able to get in touch with this on your own?
We all have.
Women have their own version of it. It's a different version.
And women's version
is, go ahead,
very difficult.
Yeah.
And culturally, men have a set of actions and ways of responding that differ, you know, that don't necessarily allow us to take in and receive.
Letting stuff in is hard for men.
Yeah.
But it's very hard for women, too, especially women who have been traumatized. And most women have been traumatized. So
exactly.
It's true. Letting stuff in is very difficult for people.
And then allowing yourself, you know, I think in this day and age, it's almost even more difficult to allow yourself to give out something positive.
Say more about that. That's really interesting.
It's easier to have the skeptical, negative outlook and just leave it with putting... It's not risking yourself. It's not putting any energy into an outcome because, well, it probably won't work anyway.
Well, you're right. A lot of people are disappointed. Disappointment is a basic theme in people's lives.
I used to have this big punching bag in my office.
Mm-hmm.
It was called a stress eliminator, mm-hmm. and it was cute. And on the back, you could write the things that stressed you. And people would write things down, and one of the biggest ones was success.
Oh, it's a big one.
You know, we're easier with failure than we are with success. So putting energy, you know, not worrying about failing is okay. But to put energy into having a success and not making it, but if you don't, as I say, if you don't shoot for your dreams... Even if you fall short, you're that much closer than not shooting for it at all.
Well, it is a curious quality of human beings, at least in our culture, that the bad things that happen to us are the things that we remember the most acutely and the fastest, and that we often forget the most beautiful, poignant things. I'm not saying that everyone does this. I think with practice we mm-hmm. learn not to do that. And to give things equal weight, but you know, that combined with the fact that whatever state you're in seems to be it.
Right.
You know, I will never, you know, I was up late last night prepping the show but there were other reasons why that happened. But anyway, so you know, you wake up in the morning, you're tired, and you automatically, I think to myself, well, that's it. I'm going to be tired now for the rest of my life. You know, you have to stop. No, you will take a nap this afternoon and it will go away. So again, to go back to this other idea that everybody has some version of this going on, but not everybody has the gift to communicate it to others or to join with others, and maybe also because there's such an accumulation of painful cellular memory or contraction that happens as a person goes through either this life or, if you want to believe it, several lives, or maybe just if you want to look at family history and look at your genetic, you know, what you inherited from, you know, already the Schmerz from God knows where.
Or maybe the future affecting the present.
Oh, dear.
Oh, please.
Oh, no. Oh, I can't even.
Yeah, don't even go there.
Oh, I don't. You better say something else about that. I don't even know what to think about what you just said. That's...
Well, if time... In the study of physics, if time isn't linear, then we've had an experience of the past, and that time being the fourth dimension is we don't have an experience necessarily in our consciousness of the future. But if the future is there to some degree, then that the ripples of an event in the future...
Oh, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah. Sorry.
Which is the misunderstanding I find that people have of the word karma, because they think karma is like retribution or punishment.
Right.
And actually, my understanding of karma is that its literal translation is action, and it is, like you said, to my feeling, ripples in the water that affect
reaction.
Everything. Yeah, action. Woo. And, you know, that's a tricky thing to talk about, because you don't want to just tighten your buttocks and try to behave properly. It doesn't work to do that, because you've been talking about this breathing out, breathing in, contraction and expansion. We learn from our mistakes, we grow from our mistakes, and yet they affect things in our world. So it's this kind of... the way that I've described it to people is similar to what you were saying, but I have my own little metaphor, which is that I see the world as this substance that appears to be solid, but it's really just a liquid substance, and like liquids, when it's exposed to the air, there's a crust on the outside. And most people run around on the crust, and they move very quickly, because if they don't, they're gonna break through. So they're running around, and they're keeping themselves very busy, and they're very preoccupied, and they're not feeling their feelings, and they're doing all this stuff, and they're running around. And then something happens. You get sick, or there's a crisis or something, and your foot kind of breaks through this crust, and you end up down in the middle of this liquid, and all bets are off at that point, because it's kind of boom, boom, and then you have to learn how to kind of, oh, I'm not even sure how to describe it, but sort of move in this viscous environment where the rules are more intuitive.
Well, right. And most people have that, and using that kind of imagery, it's an inundation, whether it's the center and it's viscous, it's water, it's the emotional body. And so we're very uncomfortable in that emotional body. And that's getting through that crust. And we like to stay in this culture of mental configuration. It's a brain mind. Getting people into their emotional bodies and experiencing that is often a great way of then, you know, through that confusion, finding that center within that to know that even with that, it's, hey, this isn't so bad. We can do this. And you've got now a new ally. Besides just the brain mind, you've got the emotional body working with you, and bring those two together to work with the physical.
Well, and that was sort of the question I was going to ask you when we got off into the future, which was that it would seem to me that some of the tools that people might use would be inner work, which is what you just said, to be able to have a relationship with their emotional life in a kind way or in an open, you know, begin to establish some kind of work like that.
Oh, exactly. And a lot of times it really helps when a patient not only sees me, but then a therapist.
Yeah, I often suggest that to people as well. And you some know? People get mad when I do that.
Oh, well yeah, they
yeah.
do.
I have to kind of saw, you know, I have to explain, you know, look, I do this when I need to, you know, there's, mm-hmm. you know. Some people say, well, I did see a therapist. And I say, well, you know, a girlfriend of mine once said, you know, so you had a rotten tooth and you went to the dentist 2 years ago and you never need to go now. So, anyway, I'm trying to think. Oh, and my last question, and I, you know, it's one of those, I think I'm so clever asking you this, but I have a feeling you're going to have an answer, is who heals?
Well, we all do. Is that C, all of the above?
Thank you for not being pretentious. Well, yeah, I think that is the right answer. I mean, I think what I'm saying is that it's easy for people to feel, well, I've gone to Greg and he put his hands on me and now everything's all right. And so Greg healed me. But I think that it's like we've been talking about. It's much more complicated than that.
Oh, it is.
And simpler.
And simpler at the same time.
There's another Zen thing that I love, because I used to get into these. I studied Buddhism very seriously when I was young. It was very formative. And so sometimes people will, I was dating someone who started to get into sort of a Dharma combat with me, and I don't like playing those kinds of games because it seems completely, I mean, even people who are obsessed with the idea of enlightenment, to me it's like they've missed the point already. So one of the things is that there's a story I'm probably telling wrong, but where somebody points at the moon, you know, a student really, and the teacher says, well, you know, if you have to point at the moon, you're already missing the moon. You're already missing it, you know. So,
yeah.
Well, even if I've told that wrong, I think at least you got it. So
that's
okay.
Close enough.
All right. I want to thank you very much for
coming
in, Greg Shelton, who does not have a website or a phone number to give out. But please do follow the tone of this show and look for your own healer somewhere out there in the world, because they're
please
out there.
Do.
Yeah. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information, or if you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests, go to the website www.yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, Dietary Fat Myths and Science. Lipid researcher Dr. Mary Innig will be back with us. The engineers for Your Own Health and Fitness are George Curtis and Phil Tynan today at the Powerhouse Brewery in Sebastopol. Thank you to Johnny Otis and the Powerhouse, and at KPFA, Sally Phillips. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Free Speech Radio, KPFA 94.1 FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.